Deuteronomy chapter 26. And reading at verse 1. And it shall be, when thou art come in unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance, and possessest it, and dwellest therein, that thou shalt take of thee first of all the fruit of the earth, which thou shalt bring of thy land that the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt put it in a basket, and shalt go unto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to place his name there. And thou shalt go unto the priest that shall be in those days, and say unto him, I profess this day unto the Lord thy God, that I am come unto the country which the Lord sware unto our fathers for to give us. And the priest shall take the basket out of thine hand, and set it down before the altar of the Lord thy God. And thou shalt speak and say before the Lord thy God, A Syrian ready to perish was my father, and he went down into Egypt, and sojourned there with a few, and became there a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians evil entreated us, and afflicted us, and laid upon us hard bondage. And when we cried unto the Lord God of our fathers, the Lord heard our voice, and looked on our affliction, and our labor, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and with an outstretched arm, and with great terribleness, and with signs, and with wonders. And he hath brought us into this place, and hath given us this land, even a land that floweth with milk and honey. And now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which thou, O Lord, hast given me. And thou shalt set it before the Lord thy God, and worship before the Lord thy God. And thou shalt rejoice in every good thing which the Lord thy God hath given unto thee, and unto thine house, thou and the Levite, and the stranger that is among you. When thou hast made an end of tithing all the tithes of thine increase the third year, which is the year of tithing, and hast given it unto the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that they may eat within thy gates and be filled, then thou shalt say before the Lord thy God, I have brought away the hallowed things out of mine house, and also have given them unto the Levite, and unto the stranger, to the fatherless, and to the widow, according to all thy commandments which thou hast commanded me. I have not transgressed thy commandments, neither have I forgotten them. I have not eaten thereof in my mourning, neither have I taken away aught thereof for any unclean use, nor given aught thereof for the dead. But I have hearkened to the voice of the Lord my God, and have done according to all that thou hast commanded me. Look down from thy holy habitation, from heaven, and bless thy people Israel, the land which thou hast given us, as thou swearest unto our fathers, a land that floweth with milk and honey. This day the Lord thy God hath commanded thee to do these statutes and judgments. Thou shalt therefore keep and do them with all thine heart, and with all thy soul. Thou hast avouched the Lord this day to be thy God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his statutes, and his commandments, and his judgments, and to hearken unto his voice. And the Lord hath avouched thee this day to be his peculiar people, as he hath promised thee, and that thou shouldest keep all his commandments, to make thee high above all nations, which he hath made, in praise, and in name, and in honour, and that thou mayest be an holy people unto the Lord thy God, as he hath spoken. In Deuteronomy chapter 26, by divine command, Moses enjoins upon the children of Israel two exercises that they must give expression to when at last they would find themselves in the land of divine promise. For in Deuteronomy chapter 26, the children of Israel are still in the wilderness, and two exercises are given them that belonged to the land to which God was bringing them. And thus we discover some five or six times in Deuteronomy chapter 26 these words, the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. God in his goodness was going to bring them to this land that he had promised them. And now Moses enjoins upon God's people, and that by divine command, two exercises that they must give expression to when at last they would be there. Both of these exercises are connected with the goodness of God to his people. The first is an expression of gratitude to God for his goodness. And the second is a petition that the Lord in his goodness would continue to bless his people. Thus both of these exercises are connected with the goodness of God to his people. I repeat, the first was an expression of gratitude to God for his goodness. Thus we read in verse 11, "Thou shalt rejoice in every good thing which the Lord thy God hath given thee." Then we have a continuation, that the Lord might continue in his goodness to bless his people. And we read in verse 15 these words, "Look down from thy holy habitation from heaven, and bless thy people Israel, and the land which thou gavest us." Now there are three sections in this chapter that I want to consider with you for a little while. The division, of course, of the chapter is fairly obvious. From verse 1 to 11, we have brought before us the basket of first fruits. Now I want to say a little word on the subject of the basket of first fruits. Then from verse 12 to 15, we have the subject of the third year's tithes. And notice I've used the expression that we have in this chapter, the third year's tithes, for this was tithing with a difference. Then from verse 16 to 19, we have the ratification of Jehovah's covenant with his people. Verse 16 to 19, the ratification of Jehovah's covenant with his people. When we think of the basket of first fruits from verse 1 to 11, there are three matters that we must consider. There is the presentation of that basket in the place where the Lord would choose to place his name. This we find in verses 2 and 4. The presentation of the basket, and in the place where the Lord had been pleased to place his name. And then we have in verses 5 to 10 the accompanying confession. For not only had they to present the basket, but this presentation was accompanied with a confession. And this was a confession to the Lord of what they were and what God had done for them. There was a confession of their unworthiness and their plight, and of divine goodness in the matter of redemption. Verse 8, "The Lord brought us forth out of Egypt." Verse 9, "And he brought us into this place." But then there was the matter of worship and rejoicing. There was the presentation of the basket, accompanying the accompanying confession, and then there is the consequent worship and rejoicing. This we find in verses 10 and 11. "Thou shalt worship before the Lord thy God." Then the third matter is the prayer for divine blessing contained in verse 15. Thus, number one, we have the distribution of the tithes. This is brought before us in verse 12. "When this made an end of tithing all the tithes of an increase, the third year, which is the year of tithing, and has given it unto the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow." There we have the distribution of the tithes. Then we have their assurance of their personal obedience. Thus we read in verse 13, "I have not transgressed thy commandments, neither have I forgotten them." Verse 14, "I have hearkened to the voice of the Lord my God, and have done according to all that thou hast commanded me." Then thirdly, we have the prayer for divine blessing. Verse 15, "Look down from thy holy habitation from heaven, and bless thy people Israel." Then in connection with the ratification of the covenant, in verses 16 to 19, we have a delightful twofold declaration. Declaration number one is contained in verse 17. "Thou hast avouched the Lord this day to be thy God." Thou hast declared this day the Lord to be thy God. The second declaration, verse 18, "And the Lord hath avouched thee this day to be his peculiar people." The Lord hath declared thee this day to be his peculiar people. Now having set out the chapter, let us consider some of its details. First of all, from verse 1 to 11, the basket of first fruits. It is touching in Deuteronomy chapter 26 to listen to Moses, the man of God, who was not himself permitted to enter the land. He is here in this chapter assuring God's people that they would enter the land. The God, in fact, was going to give it to them for an inheritance, and not because they deserved it. And when at last they would find themselves in the land, verse 1, they were to possess it and to dwell in it. When in the land that Moses himself was not to be permitted to enter, They had to both to possess it and to dwell in it. Moses had made clear to the children of Israel that God claimed the firstborn of man and of beast. But here in Deuteronomy chapter 26, he makes clear to them that God also claimed the first of the firstfruits. God claimed the first of the Israelites' firstfruits. They had to be presented to him. Why? In grateful acknowledgement that God in fact was the giver. God claimed the first of the firstfruits. They had to be presented to him in grateful acknowledgement that God in fact was the giver. I wonder what this meant for the Israelite. Just this. When the first wheat or barley appeared, the Israelitish farmer would look upon it and he would say in his heart, this has to be presented to Jehovah. When the first cluster of grapes appeared, or the first figs appeared, if he was not able on the appearance of the grapes or the figs to go to the place where God had been pleased to place his name, then the Israelite, he would not use them for himself. God had forbidden this. He would dry them until he was able to make the journey to the place where the Lord had chosen to place his name. This was true with the first pomegranate and the first date honey. These must all be presented to God. Thus down this chapter repeatedly, Jehovah God is spoken of as the great giver. And here we have an acknowledgement that God is the great giver. Verse 1, the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Verse 3, the country which the Lord sware unto our fathers for to give us. Verse 9, he hath brought us into this place and hath given us this land. Verse 10, I have brought the first fruits of the land which thou, O Lord, hast given me. And this is repeated again in verse 15. Thus we have established in our minds, in connection with the first fruits especially, that God was the great giver. Now we think of the presentation of the first fruits. This is twice mentioned. We discover that the basket of first fruits was first of all presented by the priest. Then it was presented by the Israelite himself. When the Israelite brought his basket of first fruits, verse 4 tells us that the priest would take it out of his hand, and the priest would set it down before the altar of the Lord his God. And after the confession of the Israelite himself would set the basket, according to verse 10, before the Lord his God. But notice with me, this basket was not set upon the altar. The language of verse 4 is, it was set down before the altar. Why is it that it was not set upon the altar, and in fact was set before the altar? The answer is simple. The wheat, the barley, the grapes, etc., these did not speak of Christ. Therefore they were not placed upon the altar. But these were matters that spoke of the living God, which giveth us richly all things to enjoy. These were matters which spake of divine beneficence. Thus, in their presentation, they were not placed upon the altar, but in fact placed before the altar. Now, the procedure connected with the presentation is very simple. We discover that verses 2 and 3 mention three things that we can very easily remember. And the three things are these: a place, a priest, and a profession. Thus, in connection with the presentation of the basket of first fruits, mention is made in verse 2 of a place, verse 3 of a priest, and again in verse 3 of a profession. In connection with a place in verse 2, this involved a journey to the divine center. In connection with the priest of verse 3, this involved an interview with the divine representative. And in connection with the profession, this involved an acknowledgement of divine goodness. These are matters that we can easily remember. The place involved a journey to the divine center. The priest involved an interview with the divine representative. And the profession involved an acknowledgement of divine goodness. Thus we read in verse 2, thou shalt go unto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to place his name. There we have the place. Then verse 3 we have the priest. Let it go not only to the place, but, says verse 3, and thou shalt go unto the priest that shall be in those days. The place, the priest. Then verse 3 speaks of the profession. And say unto him, that is to the priest, I profess this day unto the Lord thy God that I am come into the country which the Lord sware unto our fathers for to give us the place, the priest, and the profession. Let us think briefly of these three matters. Number one, of the place, mentioned in verse 2, when in the enjoyment of the rest of the promised land and the inheritance which God would give them, we learn of the establishment of the place where the Lord would be pleased to place his name. This is spoken of in Deuteronomy chapter 12. And Deuteronomy chapter 12 directs our attention to the first condition of the establishment of the place where the Lord would place his name. What were the first conditions? Ah, said the Lord, ye shall destroy the places where the nations served their gods, overthrow their altars, break their pillars, burn their groves, hew down their graven images, destroy the names of them. Thus, before there could be this place where the Lord would place his name, there must be the complete destruction of every other altar, every other pillar, every grove, and every graven image. I wonder why? Ah, the answer is simple. God is a jealous God. He is a God who will have no other gods beside him. In fact, every other sanctuary must be destroyed ere there could be established the place where he would place his name. And once this place was established, where Jehovah was pleased to place his name, thither they must seek, and only thither they must go. God was jealous of the place where he placed his name. You remember the guilt of Jeroboam in the first book of Kings. In order to secure the allegiance of the 10 tribes, to keep them away from the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, he set up a golden calf at Bethel and a golden calf at Dan. He gave to the 10 tribes a perimeter, but no centre. He made a house of high places. He made priests of the lowest order. He ordained a counterfeit feast, and this thing became a sin unto the Lord. For the Lord had only one place where he would be pleased to place his name. No sacrifice must be offered anywhere else. No first fruits must be presented anywhere else. And in acknowledgement of this, the Israelite must take his journey to that place, however long the journey might be. Now, my dear brethren, today there is no thought really of a place. John chapter 4 makes this clear. The woman said, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, but ye say that Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship God. The Lord Jesus went on to speak of the Father seeking worshippers who shall worship him in the Spirit, making it clear that there is no thought of a place today. But why there is no thought of a physical place today? My dear brethren, we must remember that there is a company here and a company there who testify as to the pillar and the ground of truth where God is pleased to dwell. And as the place of the name must be precious to the hearts of the Israelites in olden days, so must that company be to us who gather into the name of the Lord Jesus. We have been reminded today of our responsibility towards the local church, the local assembly in this respect. And one cannot but feel that in these days, the reason why there is so much weakness, so much ineffective service, is because we've lost the value of being in the fellowship of a local assembly. What was it that made the assemblies the power for God that they once were? I'll tell you, my young brother, my young sister, what it was. The fidelity of the people of God towards the assembly, and the love of the people of God toward the assembly. That's what made them the power that they were not so many decades ago. Dear old brother there, I believe I may have mentioned this before, in Blythe in the northeast of England, worked many hours day by day in the coal mines, small seams, lying for hours on his back in water, digging with his pick. The result was he was crippled with rheumatisms. He would come home at night and have a meal and lie before the big roaring fire, exposing his body to its warmth and praying, Lord, make these bones go, make them gain. It's the prayer meeting tonight. It's the Bible reading tonight. It's the open air meeting tonight. It's that kind of love and fidelity to the Lord's interest in local assemblies that made the assemblies the power they were for God not so many years ago. But today, where is the interest? Where is the fidelity? Where is the love for the gatherings together of God's people? The amazing thing is this, that so many are interested in big matters and big affairs many miles away and criticize the weakness of the local assembly where they're doing very little to help it. Let us appreciate, dear brethren, what it means to be in fellowship as we've been reminded. We're all in this matter. Equal sharers. Not one more than the other. And I would say here today that the condition of your local assembly is as much a reflection on you as it is on anyone else. But then not only the place. There was the priest. Verse 3. Thank God there was more than a place for the Israelite. There was a person in the place who was awaiting the Israelite, with whom he had this interview, and he would take from him his basket and set it down before the altar. Thank God we too have a person. We have a priest who takes from our hand what we bring and sets it down, so to speak, before the altar. My dear brethren, what an unspeakable joy it is, as most of us know, not only to be with God's people, but to meet with the Lord. There's no happier experience than that, than just to be with the people of God and to meet with the Lord himself. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I. There am I in the midst of them. We've been reminded of his omnipresence. Lo, I'm with you always. He's with the big companies. He's with the small companies, gathered into his name. And each of them has the glorious privilege of enjoying something that the world and Christendom knows nothing about, to meet with the Lord. I'm sure you look back on times in your experience when just to be in his presence, particularly on a Lord's Day morning, meant more to you in the world than anything else. The place, the priest, and then there was the profession. Verse 3, I profess this day unto the Lord thy God, that I am come into the country which the Lord sware unto our fathers to give us. There was this profession. I profess. What did this profession mean? Well, Israelite, in fact, just said this. I declare, by my presence here in this place, and that openly I'm declaring it, not only to God, but to man, that I am come into the promised land, and I'm enjoying it. And that's why I'm here. That was the profession. My dear brethren, our presence too at the assembly gatherings, at the gatherings together of the Lord's people, becomes a profession. That we have come into the enjoyment of God's grace, his gracious and his bountiful provision. Our failure to be with God's people when they gather together, no matter what excuse we might make, betrays this, that we're not in the enjoyment of divine grace. If we are, we shall certainly be there. And thus, in the enjoyment of God's gracious dealings with them, they went to the place, they did an interview with a person, and there was this public declaration that they were in the enjoyment of divine things. Then verse 5 to 10, we have the confession. We'll read this confession. You've read it often before. I love the language of it. And thou shalt speak and say before the Lord thy God, a Syrian ready to perish was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there with a few, and became there a nation great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians entreated us and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. And when we cried unto the Lord God of our fathers, the Lord heard our voice and looked on our afflictions and our labor and our oppression. And the Lord brought us forth out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with great terribleness and with signs and wonders. And he hath brought us into the place, into this place, and hath given us this land, even a land that floweth with milk and honey. And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which thou, O Lord, hast given to me. This could afford us an hour or two's consideration, but that, of course, we dare not attempt. But let us think of the burden of this confession. We discover that in this confession, there was a confession on the part of the Israelite, number one, of what they were, and number two, of what God had done for them. I repeat this, a twofold confession. Number one, of what they were. Number two, of what God had done for them. This confession of what they were involved two things. Number one, Assyrian ready to perish. Verse 5. Verse 6, Egyptian laid upon us hard bondage. Thus they had been a perishing people and a people in bondage. I've no doubt that Assyrian ready to perish takes us back to Genesis chapter 42 and 43, where we read of the famine in the land, and Jacob said, "Go, buy that we live and not die." Thus there were people perishing through hunger. There was famine, and said Jacob, "Go and buy that we live and do not die." Assyrian ready to perish through hunger. But not only were they hungry and perishing, but they experienced bondage. Verse 6, the Egyptians laid upon us hard bondage. And of course the book of Exodus fills out the details of this for us. The details briefly mentioned in verse 6 and 7. Thus observe, the confession of what they were involved, two things. They had known hunger, and they had known bondage. What had God done for them? God had done two things for them. Verse 8, He brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Verse 9, He brought us into this place. Now let us observe. Verse 8, He brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. That was the end of their bondage. But verse 9, He brought us into this place and hath given us this land, even the land that floweth with milk and honey. That was the end of their hunger. If they had known hunger, now they were brought into a land flowing with milk and honey. If they had known bondage, God had brought them out of their bondage, out of the land of Egypt, with a mighty hand. In answer to their cry, God had moved on their behalf. Now I want you to observe with me, dear brethren, how graphic is the description of divine intervention in verses 7 and 8. Here's a matter that touches my spirit. God's ear, His eye, His hand, His arm was involved as He intervened on the behalf of His people. What a God we have. How deeply interested is He in His people? His eye was involved, His ear was involved. Verse 7, the Lord heard our voice. His eye was involved, He looked on our afflictions. His hand was involved. Verse 8, He brought us forth with a mighty hand. His arm was involved. Verse 8, and with an outstretched arm. Thus ear and eye and hand and arm, God had intervened on the behalf of His people. But we have known redemption, Lord, from bondage worse than there by far. Now God intervened on their behalf in such a wonderful way. Praise God, has intervened on our behalf in just as wonderful a way. We think briefly of the parable with which we're all familiar in Luke chapter 15, the parable of the prodigal. There he was, he knew something of slavery. He's feeding swine. He knew something of hunger. He fain would have filled his belly with the husks that the swine had eaten. Thus, like Israel, he had experienced slavery, and he had experienced hunger. But the Father had moved on his behalf. How did the Father move on the part of the prodigal? I suppose you've noticed, dear brethren, that the Father's eye was involved. His heart was involved. His feet were involved. His arm were involved. And his mouth as well. All involved in the part of that prodigal son. His eye was involved when he was a great way off. His father saw him. Then his heart, he had compassion on him. And his feet, he ran. His arms, he fell on his neck. And his mouth, and he kissed him. And from being a slave, he became a son clothed in the best robe. And from hungry, he's seen sitting at the table feasting upon the fatted calf. There we have divine grace on the part of Israel. Divine grace on the part of the prodigal. And praise God, each one of us can testify to grace just as remarkable on our part as well. But then we have in verses 10 and 11, the worship and the rejoicing of the Israelite. Verse 10, thou shalt set it before the Lord thy God, and worship before the Lord thy God. Verse 11, and thou shalt rejoice in every good thing which the Lord thy God hath given thee, and unto thine house thou and the Levite, and the stranger that is among thee. The issue was worship and rejoicing. Thus this presentation, this confession, had to be much more than mere ritual. The Israelite, gripped with a deep sense of God's mercy in salvation, God's grace in his bountiful provision, their hearts had to be lifted up in worship and rejoicing. It wasn't merely a ritual. It was intended to produce in them worship and rejoicing. And notice verse 1 says, "And it shall be when they were come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee." Here was the first thought that bringing these tithes, bringing these first fruits, they would be a worshipping people. And my dear brethren, we have not time to deal with this now. But this is God's thought with regard to you and me. And this is putting first things first. Divine grace and mercy in your experience and mine is intended to make us, first of all, worshippers. That's first things first. Worshippers. The first thing that Noah did, having been preserved by God through the judgment of the flood, was to build an altar and offer his burnt offerings to God. And having redeemed his people out of Egypt, God said, "No, I want to dwell amongst you, and I want you to worship me." And we haven't time to see how that this is set before us delightfully in the New Testament. But not only worshippers, but they were to be a rejoicing people. Rejoicing in every good thing. My dear brethren, this was characteristic of the early saints. We've been reading in Acts chapter 2, and there we're told that they did eat their meat with gladness. Acts chapter 16, the jailer set meat before them and rejoiced, believing in God with all his house. And God's people ought to be a worshipping people and a rejoicing people as well. I believe the Apostle Paul tells us in Philippians chapter 3 that there is safety in rejoicing. Spiritual safety in rejoicing. Why, he says, to write the same things to you. What things? This constant repetition to rejoice, he says, to write these same things to you, to me indeed. It is not grievous, it is not irksome, but for you it is safe. I recognize that the safety, the spiritual safety in rejoicing on the part of God's people. Then briefly, the third year's tithes, verses 12 to 15. Now perhaps I ought to say just a brief word on the matter of the third year's tithes. On tithing, in fact, in general, as it's brought before us in the Old Testament. The giving of a tenth part to God, or to his representative, was practiced long before that it was incorporated, of course, in the Mosaic Law. You remember that Abraham gave tithes of his spoils to Melchizedek, Genesis chapter 14. And in Genesis chapter 27, Jacob vowed that he would give to God the tenth of all that God might give to him. Thus, it was practiced long before it was incorporated in the Mosaic Law. But we must understand the tithing of Deuteronomy chapter 26. And in order to understand it, let me mention this. In Leviticus chapter 27, verses 30 to 33, we're told that a tithe of all the Israelites' produce had to be given to the Levites. We've interesting details in regard to that tithe. Numbers 18 tells us that a tenth of this tithe had to be given to the priests, and that a tithe of all the Israelites' produce had to be given to the Levites, and a tenth of that tithe had to be given to the priests. But in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 6 to 12, verse 4, and chapter 14, verse 22 to 27, tells us of another tithe. It was a second tithe of all the Israelites' produce. What had to happen to this second tithe of all the Israelites' produce? This had to be taken to Jerusalem. Deuteronomy chapter 12 tells us this. Or if the distance be too great, that tithe had to be converted into money, and at Jerusalem the Israelite could purchase anything that he wished, and this was to be eaten by himself, his children, and any Levite that might then be with him. But when we come to Deuteronomy chapter 26, the chapter that we're considering, in conjunction with Deuteronomy 14 verse 28 and 29 and Amos chapter 4, we've yet another tithing. And this is a tithing with a difference. What tithing is this? Deuteronomy 26 verse 12 speaks of it as the year of tithing. It was the tithing of every third year. It was the third year tithing which was tithing with a difference. And what was the difference in the third year tithing? Let me point out this. The third year tithing was not taken to Jerusalem.
verse 12 of Deuteronomy chapter 26 tells us it was eaten within the Israelites' gates. Not taken to Jerusalem, but in fact eaten within the gates of the Israelite. Number two, it was shared with the Israelites' children and the Levites. But more, the stranger shared in this, and the fatherless and the widow. It was more widespread in its distribution. Now let's think of the distribution of the tithes very hurriedly. Verse 12, when this made an end of tithing all the tithes of an increase the third year, which is the year of tithing, and has given it unto the Levite. Why the Levite? The Levite was a man who had no earthly possessions. A man who was devoted to the work of the Lord. Share it with him. And the stranger, the individual who had no home. And the fatherless, those who had nobody to care for them. And the widow, who was without a breadwinner. How great and beneficent and kind our God is. He would forget none. Thus, if in verses 1 to 11, in connection with the basket of the first fruits, the heart of the Israelite went up to God in worship. In verses 12 and 13, in the matter of the tithes, the Israelites hearted out in benevolence to others. My dear brethren, this is no doubt the mind of God. Number one, that our heart go up first of all to him in worship. That's the tithes. That's the first fruits. In connection with the tithes, our hearts go out in beneficence and kindness to others. And I believe, though we haven't time to develop this, that the truest worshipper is always the most liberal giver. And if one's heart goes up in worship at all, one's heart must go out in beneficence and kindness to others. Then in verses 13 and 14 we have the assurance of the Israelites' personal obedience. We haven't time to deal with this in detail. But let us observe that no loopholes were offered in this confession. The Israelite must make an honest confession, and no loopholes. There was that was negative, and that was positive. What was negative? Verse 13. I have not transgressed, that is deliberately, thy commandments. Neither have I forgotten them, that's negligently. Furthermore, I haven't withheld them, I haven't counted them, I've counted them as hallowed, and I've given to the Levite and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow. There we have the negative assurance of obedience. Then the positive assurance, verse 14. I have hearkened to the voice of the Lord my God, and have done according to all that thou hast commanded me. Here we have the positive assurance of outward obedience to the commandment of the Lord. Then we have in verse 15 the prayer for divine blessing. Verse 15. Look down from thy holy habitation from heaven, and bless thy people Israel, and the land which thou hast given us, as thou swearest unto our fathers, a land that floweth with milk and honey. Notice now, my dear brethren, and we can't go into the details. Number one, they assure God of their implicit obedience to his commandment. Then their heart goes up in a petition for divine blessing. My dear brethren, let us observe in a practical way today that blessing can only be asked for by the obedient. They had to assure the Lord of their unswerving obedience to him. And then the prayer went up to heaven that God in turn might bless them. My brother, my sister, I appeal to you today, as I appeal to myself. Can you say, can I say, I have not transgressed, I have not forgotten, I have hearkened, I have done according to all that thou hast commanded me? Look down and bless. My brother, my sister, this is the order. Is it not true that nothing rebukes us when we're seeking divine blessing than a consciousness of disobedience in the life? Thus we have the confession of their obedience preceding the request for divine blessing. Then finally, the ratification of the divine covenant, verses 16 and 19. Said Moses to the Israelite in verse 17, thou hast avouched, thou hast declared, thou hast owned the Lord this day, while you're still in the wilderness, to be thy God, to walk in his ways, the ways that he will make known to you, to keep his statutes, those things he has enacted for you, and his commandments, those things that he has laid upon you, and his judgments, those decisions he has declared unto you, and to hearken to his voice through his servants. Verse 17. Verse 18. And the Lord hath avouched thee this day to be his peculiar people, his peculiar treasure, as he hath promised thee, and that thou shouldest keep his commandments, verse 18, and to make thee high above all nations which he hath made, to make thee uppermost in the nations, in praise to himself, and in name, that's in renown, in honour, the word is beauty. Thus, my dear brethren, I conclude by mentioning this. In the basket of first fruits, we have worship. In the tithes, we have benevolence. In the ratification of the covenant, we have complete surrender to God. Notice, they were commanded to keep and to do his statutes and judgments. Verse 16, with all thine heart, with all thy soul, verse 17, to walk in his ways and to hearken to his voice. I wonder what this means. In connection with the basket of the first fruits, this is Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15. By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually. That is the fruit of our lips, confessing his name. In the tithes, we have Hebrews 13, verse 16. But to do good and to communicate of your substance, forget not, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. In the ratification of the covenant, we have Romans chapter 12. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, the sacrifice of our persons. My dear brethren, Israelite had this to say, I'll keep thy commandments and thy statutes with all my heart. Lord, here's my heart. With all my soul, Lord, here's my soul. I'll walk in thy ways, Lord, take my feet. I'll hearken to thy voice, Lord, take my ears. Thus, as his peculiar treasure, they say, take my heart, take my soul, take my feet, and take mine ears. Says Paul, and ye are not your own. Ye have been bought with a price. Again, says Paul in Romans chapter 6, yield yourselves unto God and your members as instruments of righteousness unto God. The closing section of this chapter involves this. I am thine, O Lord. I have heard thy voice. We yield ourselves without reserve to the God whose purchase, whose treasure we are.